You're listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners. To donate, click on the Canada Helps button or go to westhill.net/donate.
As we begin our Academy Award series, Les Miserables is the first movie that we are exploring. And we're exploring it in the context of communication, as we are all of the movies that we're going to look at this year. I spoke last week about communication using a book called Difficult Conversations to open up how it is that we talk to one another, how it is that we have these conversations that are challenging and very real. And I want to reiterate a bit of that for you today and then move into the movie. In the book Difficult Conversations, the authors, who are part of a mediation program at Harvard University, remind us that in every conversation we're actually having three conversations. There's three conversations going on at the same time, though we're generally oblivious to them. If we do pay attention to them, we have a much better chance of actually getting through the conversation without being clawed by someone or in turn clawing someone else. The three conversations that are going on are the what happened conversation, the feelings conversation, and the identity conversation. The what happened conversation ensues when people try to figure out exactly what went wrong, who did what to whom, and how things unfolded that got you to the point that you're having to have a difficult conversation. And it's made up itself of three different components. The one is the truth, because we all go into these conversations knowing that we have the truth and we're the only ones, and we are going to lay it out for the person we're having the conversation with and find out where their understanding needs to be corrected. But as the authors point out, no one has the entire truth as we go into these conversations. There's always something else that has to be said. And so he talks about an exercise of finding out what that truth is. So rather than going and telling, we go and ask, what happened here? How did we get here? And of course, we get a much better picture, although even bringing those fragments together may not result in what it is that we need. The next one is the one that I disclosed I have some of the most difficulty with, and that is imputing intent. I assume that someone says something to me because they're trying to teach me a lesson or because they're remembering something I said 2 weeks ago that they want to remind me was the inappropriate thing to say. And so I look for intention when I'm entering into a difficult conversation. And indeed, I have no way of knowing what someone's intention is. Scott and I had a conversation about that on the way here today, about intention, where I imputed intention and he imputed it right back to me, and you know, we'll probably have to pick it up afterward and try to figure out the rest of it. But intent is something that we can't know what the other person's intentions were until we ask. And then finally, the last one is blame, because we go in and we clearly are looking who we can blame. And the authors try to steer you toward, and this is a hard one, realizing that no particular person is to blame, that it was a contribution of effort that created that situation. And that contribution of efforts makes what happened happen. And recognizing that helps us to get to a different understanding. Feelings, of course, is that when by the time we get to a difficult conversation, our feelings are very involved in it, and our attempts to pretend that they're not or to shut them down don't help. It's helpful for us to say, I'm angry with you, or I was hurt by what you did, and then carrying on from that. So disclosing our feelings and having conversation about that helps. And then the third one that the authors set up, the identity one, is every conversation, every difficult conversation is about how you see me and how I see me, and what does it mean if I actually did things the way that you think I did them? What are you saying about who I am? And what do I now believe about who I am? And that conversation is a very real one. So we'll weave these into our my perspective on Les Mis, which becomes your perspective. You'll see the S, a couple of people after the service last week, when I shifted the name of this part of the service from meditation, which had it had been named probably 20 years ago, to perspective, And they suggested that I add an S to it, to make it perspectives, to recognize that it really is something that is a give and take that we all participate in. But I put the S in brackets because it's only if you embrace my perspective with your own that we get to that larger picture that we need in order to shift and challenge and change the world. And of course, as you add yours to it, then you want to add another S to it and make it larger as you take it from this place. So it's a snowballing, we hope, effect of perspectives being shared so that we all grow in an understanding. Now, as we move into Les Miserables, I want to remind you that I am not a historian. I'm particularly not a French historian, and I've actually only brought my readings and not my notes on the history of this, so be gentle with me as we go through this. But I think that the history of Les Mis is very important, and it goes back to the French Revolution and some of the things that sparked the French Revolution. And if you will go to the first, there's a couple of pictures. Carrie, if you'll go to the first picture after that, this is a picture of one of the situations that sparked the French Revolution in 1789. And that was the financial situation that France was in at the time. Having come through and contributed to wars around it, and having a taxation system that was simply not supporting the expense of the government, it was in a dismal financial situation. And this is a caricature of what some felt. The first estate being the clergy, the second estate being royalty, and the third estate being everybody else in France. This picture shows how the everybody else in France, the third estate, were being crippled by the weight of the clergy and the royalty. I'm that one at the front. You see that? Yeah, that's me. The clergy and the royalty had massive tax breaks, but the third estate didn't have the tax breaks, and so they were paying a huge amount of money to keep the government going. And attempts to rewrite that, of course, were not welcomed by the monarchy, and were often not even supported by the clergy. So this is one cartoonist's depiction of that which created the scenario out of which, one of the elements that created the scenario out of which the French Revolution came into being. But of course, Les Miserables is not about the French Revolution, it's about another little revolution, an attempt that took place many years later in 1832. After a subsequent revolution happened in 1830, the monarchy had been put back on the throne, and then when George X was run out of France, a relative of his was put on the throne again. And so the people who had fought long and hard for a constitution, for a republic, for the opportunity for this third estate to be able to stand up and participate and have their voice heard, were very upset about some of the ways that this happened. And we have the story that unfolds in Les Miserables. Victor Hugo was actually writing another book at the time of this minor revolt, and was caught in the crossfire as it was taking place, and hid himself between a couple of pillars for many hours. He'd been caught, he couldn't make his way through the streets because barricades had been set up, and it set this whole uprising indelibly upon his mind and his heart. And so the book Les Miserables, 1200 page, five volume book, no, I haven't read it, set that into the historical record in a way that it probably wouldn't have been if it were not for Hugo's efforts in this respect. So what was happening at the time? Some more words from Victor Hugo. Teach the ignorant as much as you can. Society is culpable in not providing a free education for all, and it must answer for the night which it produces. If the soul is left in darkness, sins will be committed. The guilty one is not he who commits the sin, but he who causes the darkness. It's very clear that Hugo is bringing to the conversation part of his perspective, which is that we cannot continue to move in this way that ignores the plight of those who are being oppressed, ignores the poverty, ignores the lack of choices, ignores the horrific conditions out of which this story grows. At the opening of Les Miserables, we see water and we are stunned almost as we look and we see, trying to bring this upturned ship into harbor, hundreds of men in the water, pulling at ropes, heaving at ropes to bring them in, prisoners who had been put into that kind of work, had become slaves of the Republic in doing that kind of work at that time. And Jean Valjean, that's his last act as a prisoner, as we see in the movie. He is freed after that, but is so oppressed by the rules that are placed upon him, the restrictions around his movement, the need to always disclose his criminal past to whoever might employ him, and in frustration, he tears those documents up and breaks free of his past to recreate himself as a valuable and contributing member of society. So Hugo is looking at these structures, at these laws and rules, and the way they are being portioned out amongst the country's poorest, most afflicted people, and challenging them in a way that creates what is this illegal response by Jean Valjean. Now, the story transpires. Jean Valjean becomes that respectable citizen that he wants to, the mayor of a small town, responsible for the well-being of many people in the factories that he runs, and Fantine's story opens up. Fantine is working in his factory. She's ridiculed and picked upon by the other women, and a story about her is fabricated and believed, and so she is turned out of the factory. In that situation, there aren't options. There's no social safety net. There's no possibility for another job. There's nothing coming down the pipe that she can grasp and hope for. And so, with a small child being cared for by some hoteliers elsewhere, she turns to a life of prostitution, sells her hair, has her teeth pulled out in the movie, and sings this dramatic song about dreaming a dream. Now, the reviewers weren't really nice about Les Mis, the movie. Picking up on some of the elements of Les Mis, the grand theatrical production that was staged in the 80s and 90s, saying that there's really only about four tunes through the whole song, through the whole play, that it was created in that time of sort of gauche musicals that brought these great contrivances to the theater. Les Miserables, if those of you who saw it will remember, it had that stage that turned, which was like a breakthrough in theater, and mesmerizing, just like the helicopter of Miss Saigon and the chandelier flying down to the ground in Phantom of the Opera. These huge techniques that were to bring our attention to these stories, but in a way that we could still enter the theater wrapped up in, you know, furs and fancy jewelry, and watch a story about the most oppressed and people without that history can tell us about. So bringing that to a movie was a challenge, and the director is criticized by some of his reviewers for the way that he comes right in for these songs being sung by members of the cast. One of them even talked about, you called them tonsil songs. And the vast pulling back in these pictures of this, the grayness of Paris, huge shots, wide angle shots, and then jumping back to these very close, intense, personal shots, it made some of them dizzy. I didn't get dizzy at all. No. I'm not a theater expert, so I don't critique it like that. I was seeing this massive city and understanding that as it came in for the close-up, it could have gone anywhere. It wouldn't have been Anne Hathaway at the other place, maybe, and might not have sung so well, but anywhere in that city, that degradation, that horror, that despair could have come to a close-up. As Scott and I left the theater, we both noted that many times in some of the bigger songs, the people who were singing them missed their note, their voices cracked, they didn't quite make it. And it all just added to me to the reality of it. It brought us closer to that than I think it did in the theater when you had perfection offering a song that is supposedly being offered by someone who is utterly broken. And so to have that very human, emotional part influencing the performance part was extremely powerful to me. But the story overall, and the reason that I put this picture on, is because it's just so similar to what's going on today. Except that clergy aren't making a whole lot of money anymore. Yeah. The church, however, is getting a pass on taxes, and we're all familiar with that. We're all, many of you are benefiting from that. Most of you are benefiting from that in one way or another. The congregation as a whole benefits from the tax system that allows me to write off part of my income as housing allowance. Huge swaths of properties, many of them prime properties, are owned by churches and denominations across this country, none of it taxable property. And that conversation is one that we wait for with trepidation because we know it will affect us terribly, but we also know that it's a conversation that we will have to have at some point in time, particularly congregations like ours that have moved beyond some of the beliefs that would privilege religious institutions, even as we look at the work that religious institutions do in providing and contributing to the social safety net of this country. So the conversation needs to take place, but whether or not religious institutions just get a pass because they happen to be identified as religious institutions may be on the table at some point in time. But the dramatic uprisings that have taken place over the last 2 or 3 years related to the Occupy movement is so reminiscent of the conditions that brought about the French Revolution in the 1780s that this picture seemed important to place before us. Because our world is moving to solidify some of those things that will put that oppression, will put that degradation, will almost codify it and make it part of the laws of the land. And we are responsible for that, being the voices that actually bring into Parliament those that will govern us. We are the people. We are the people who make those choices. We are the people who make those decisions. And in some countries around the world, that relationship is so fragile that coups and overthrows take place and new groups come in to lead the people. But in our system, with a smaller and smaller number of people heading to the polls on a sort of downward graph, we have to have the conversation about what is important to us. If you could bring the next slide up. This is the picture of the famous painting that was that came out of the 1830 French Revolution, and it's justice leading the people forward. The call to justice, some 30, 40 years after the end of the French Revolution, 30 some years after the French Revolution, the official French Revolution, had still not been met. And so a further tweaking, another revolution took place with horrible deaths and terrible losses and a trashing of the city's core. But a new understanding was brought forward. Of course, in 1832, when this other smaller uprising came into being, those who were in power at the time remembered this picture and they hid it so that it wouldn't inspire those who were revolutionaries to try to take their position, which they had achieved through revolution. And so this painting went by the by. But we can see in the Occupy movement that energy coming to the fore, that anger and that desire for dialogue of some form or another. And the reality is if that communication, those difficult conversations aren't had, if we don't sit down and look at what it is that's happened that got us here, if we don't identify our feelings and recognize who we are as we come to the table, table, then we end up with that kind of horror, that spilling of blood, that uprising that takes place in so many places around this world. We have a democracy that sets our rights out and gives us access to our government in ways that many people around this world don't have. But I would argue that there are still, in this country, this democratic country, blocks to democracy. Blocks of our own making, blocks of the making of the government, blocks of making of our communities, blocks within the system that keep us from being the voice of the people of the land, of being the voice of democracy and participating fully. Those of you who have seen another way that the world could work, another way that Canada could operate, who have considered participating in that democracy in another way, are there ways that you can think of that are blocks to democracy? In France, they had those three estates, the clergy and the monarchy and the rest of the people, and they called together those people to take votes and to make decisions periodically, 1641 and then 1732, a long split between them. But they worked out a way for them to have a conversation in a way that wasn't rigged, that couldn't privilege the monarchy. But how do we have those conversations? How do we engage our government? What are your blocks to that democracy? Are there any? Are there ways that we should be engaging that we aren't? And are there reasons that we aren't? Okay, I'll take it as an unanswerable question. I think that some of those blocks are around that idea of communication. I think that we are intimidated by those that we vote and elect into office. I think that we think that maybe our perspective isn't important enough, or that if we just share it with the people around us, it will be sufficient. And that is a very good thing to do. But I was pleased to see that Ruth is offering an opportunity for those who have been looking at the Aboriginal history and justice and current situations, and offering an opportunity to get together to talk about how to engage your member of parliament, how to talk to your elected representatives. Others lead courses periodically on how to write a letter to the editor that will be published. How do we remember that we have a voice in that conversation, that we have a part in that conversation, that we have much to say. As we look at Les Miserables, the communication was blocked entirely. The people didn't have a voice, hadn't had a voice for a long time. The monarchy and the clergy ran the country. And once that had been shifted, every time it looked like the monarchy and the clergy were going to take over again and start running it, the people revolted, because they would not live in that way again. And so those conversations had to take place. Now, one of the elements within Les Miserables, which is hugely important, is the love story. There's a love story that takes place. Cosette and Marius fall in love. They spend an hour in the presence of one another and tell the whole story of themselves to the other, and so fall deeply, tragically in love. And so, because of that, actually, Marius is saved toward the end of the movie, and doesn't learn until the very end that it was Jean Valjean who actually saved him, pulled him to safety where all his friends were killed. But the reason I think that the love story is such a significant part of Les Miserables is is the same reason that I think love stories are important to any influence that we would wield in our democracies. If we don't care, we don't participate. If we don't love, we don't care. And if we don't love desperately, hugely, with all of our being, we don't sacrifice. And so I think we don't have those big conversations. Yeah, it takes a particular kind of love to have a conversation about intent on the way to the church in the car, but the conversations that we have about what's important, about our children's education, about care for the elderly, about relationships and who can be legally married, those conversations take place because people have fallen in love. They've fallen in love with their children, with their families, with their lovers, and they want to make a change in the world because that love needs to be protected. And so the love that happens in Les Miserables, although it seems almost a subplot to the great tragedy of that revolutionary moment, that love displayed is what makes that revolution possible. It's what calls us to engage in the democratic process, because we don't want the world to be this way for the people that we love. We want it to change, and so we make our voices known. I'm going to read just two more things. One is just the refrain from the Red and Black song, and this is where I think the lack of communication takes us. Red, the blood of angry men. Black, the dark of ages past. Red, a world about to dawn. Black, the night that ends at last. Without conversation, we end up in revolution. And revolution too often brings with it, before the dawn, brings a very dark, dark night. This final reading is again from Victor Hugo, and I bring it to you because I just think it's so good. It's just such a great synopsis of what the purpose of his writing those 1,200 pages was about, and the purpose of those who have staged that story in so many different ways, those who put that grandiose element to it in the 80s and 90s, and those who set it before us as a film. So long as there shall exist, by reason of law and custom, a social condemnation which, in the midst of civilization, artificially creates a hell on earth and complicates with human fatality a destiny that is divine. So long as the three problems of the century, the degradation of man by the exploitation of his labor, the ruin of women by starvation, and the atrophy of childhood by physical and spiritual night, are not solved, so long as, in certain regions, social asphyxia shall be possible, in other words, and from a still broader point of view, so long as ignorance and misery remain on earth, there should be a need for books such as this. I found the film of Les Miserables deeply moving. It reminded me of how deep love can be. And it reminded me of how deep our need for communication can be. Communication that repairs before those things that are broken tear communities apart.